World Radio is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Patrick Riley, a real estate professional with Century 21 Select, specializing in properties in Chico and Butte Meadows. Patrick is dedicated to helping buyers and sellers achieve their real estate goals with kind, quality service. Patrick can be reached at 530-588-6593 or on Facebook. And by Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 40 years in the heart of downtown Chico at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling Cotton Party at 530-893-4923. All right, we're here at KZFR 90.1 FM out of Chico, California, broadcasting to all of the North State and really beyond as well. You can hop on to KZFR online at kzfr.org. Next up is a piece in Justice Show. This is just to remind you that everything we discuss on this show, our opinions, belong only to the guest and the host alone, and do not relate to anybody else at KZFR. And so with that, let's go to the piece in Justice Show. Hi, everybody. This is Aaron Zelnick on the Peace and Justice Show. I'm here with a colleague and a friend, Professor Stephen Lewis, who teaches at the History Department at Chico State. I asked him to come today to talk to us, to explain to us a little bit about the stuff that's going on, especially in Venezuela regarding recent events that transpired there. But also, we're going to kind of take it later on towards the end. We'll talk a little bit more about other Latin American countries, since that's his wheelhouse. Since we have him here, I'll interrogate him a bit more. So, in any event, let's just get to it. Hi, Steve. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks for the invitation.
Thanks for agreeing on a relatively short notice. So you teach Latin American history at Chico mm-hmm. State, and you've been teaching these days, kind of reshaping a little bit some of your classes, just from conversations that we've had because of all the stuff that's been going on. So you've been kind of in the middle of kind of thinking about these things quite a bit, I imagine. So can you give us a brief overview of the situation in Venezuela before the kidnapping of Maduro and the situation now?
Sure. I think in order to understand Venezuela today, we have to understand Hugo Chavez and the Chavista state that he created. So Chavez was born into humble circumstances. His parents were school teachers. He came of age in the Venezuelan army. He actually graduated with a degree in engineering. And he had an almost boyish admiration for the South American independence hero Simón Bolívar. In fact, there are stories of Chavez holding cabinet meetings and pulling up an empty seat for Bolívar, who died in 1830. So I should also state that the Venezuelan military has a tradition of revolutionary nationalism that you don't find in most of the other militaries in South America. And Chavez comes out of this tradition of revolutionary nationalism. In fact, as early as the late 1970s, he was beginning to create cells or organizations within the military designed to eventually become part of the solution to Venezuela's problems. So Chavez had this vision of the army being part of the solution to Venezuela's problems. In the 1980s and 1990s, the Venezuelan political system collapsed. There were two kind of centrist political parties that shared power back and forth, but they were both corrupt and unresponsive to the needs of ordinary Venezuelans. And Chavez was, in 1992, Chavez thought that the time had come to launch a coup to try to take power from this corrupt and discredited political system. So he and fellow conspirators launched the coup, and Chavez was the one charged with taking Caracas, the capital and the biggest city in the country, and he had to surrender. Before he fully surrendered, he negotiated with the authorities and said, "I just want to go on television so I can tell my fellow conspirators and the Venezuelan people that it's not going to work, that we failed." And so he speaks to the cameras for 90 seconds, and he says, "We have failed for now to take power and implement our Bolivarian revolutionary movement." And so with that, those two words, por ahora, for now, he became a bit of a folk hero. And so when he was sentenced to prison, served a 2-year term, and when he got out, he again had a certain notoriety. And by the time he'd gotten out, the president had been impeached, the banking system had collapsed in the country, and again, these two traditional political parties were utterly discredited. So he was able to stitch together a few small lefty parties and win the election in 1988. It was, I mean, kind of incredible.
1998?
1998, yeah.
Yeah.
And then 1 year later, he was able to call a constitutional convention and rewrite the Constitution. So with a new constitution, then, he then had the good fortune of presiding over the country when oil prices hit all-time highs following the George W. Bush administration's invasion of Iraq in 2003. So he had a lot of money. He was able to invest in social programs. He created Telesur, which is kind of the Global South's answer to CNN in Espanol. He created a development bank that was intended to be an alternative, the Global South's alternative to the IMF and the World Bank, right? So he had a lot of money, and he was quite popular. He won lots of elections. It should be said, though, that the longer he stayed in power, the more he wanted more power. And so he did have an authoritarian streak. He ruled by decree on four occasions. He manipulated the judiciary and began to pressure media outlets that he didn't like. But he was a skillful politician, very charismatic. He would star in a television show called Aló Presidente, where he would basically talk to the camera for 3 or 4 or 5 hours as long as he wanted. In a way, it was kind of like Fidel Castro's speeches in Havana, where he would just go until he was done. He would sing, he would dance. He was quite a character. In 2011, though, he was diagnosed with cancer and began getting treatment in Cuba. In 2012, he ran for re-election. It was a hard-fought election. He won it, but he was very clearly ill. And when he left for Cuba for the final time, he said, "If anything happens to me, Nicolás Maduro should succeed me." And that decision surprised a lot of people because Maduro was relatively unknown. There were other more likely candidates. But anyway, when Chavez died, then the Chavista state, the Venezuelan state, called a very quick election, and Maduro barely won. So he was running on Chavez's memory. They turned Chavez into a saint and a martyr in a way. Maduro barely pulled it off. The problem, Maduro had a lot of problems. One was that he did not have the political skill and charisma of Hugo Chavez. He couldn't sing and dance and charm people the way Chavez could. He also didn't come out of the army, so he didn't have that legitimacy that Chavez had with the army. And oil prices began to fall in 2014, and so the goose that lays the golden egg is oil in Venezuela. They have the largest proven reserves of oil in the world, but there's less money coming in, and the oil infrastructure was quite antiquated. And so Maduro, I think, and this is based on what a lot of people have written or have at least suggested, that Maduro involved the military in corruption schemes in order to stay in power. So he had to sort of buy their loyalty. Maduro ran for re-election on two occasions. On both occasions, the primary, there's obvious fraud, and the principal opposition candidates were not allowed to run. So in a way, I see Maduro as low-hanging fruit for someone trying to legitimize or justify an intervention, right? And when the Trump administration and Rubio began pressuring Maduro, it's interesting how quiet the rest of South America was. Mm-hmm. So Lula didn't say much. Gustavo Petro, president of Colombia, didn't say much, and he's a leftist. Maduro was kind of left on his own. Everyone realized he was a dictator and a thug, human rights violator. Maybe it was time he go, right? That doesn't justify the U.S.'s action, which was a kidnapping and a blatant violation of international law, of course. Now, the U.S. has dominated the Western Hemisphere since 1898 when it intervened in the Spanish-Cuban conflict. And its methods of domination have varied over time. Now, we are apparently back to the age of gunboat diplomacy. Mm-hmm. Period from roughly 1898 to 1930, when the U.S. invaded and occupied several countries in its so-called backyard. So Haiti, the Dominican Republic, Cuba, Nicaragua, and other countries. So in these cases, it was the U.S.'s military or naval strength that was used. Mm-hmm. And then these occupations, some of them lasted as long as, 8 years. As for what's happening today, Maduro's vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, is now serving as president. Her brother Jorge is like her chief political operator. And then Diosdado Cabello is there. Cabello is considered sort of like the hardline Chavista. He's in charge of the army. Now, Rodriguez is a savvy, dedicated Chavista, a socialist. And I wonder how long she'll be willing to rule as Trump and Rubio's puppet, right? Mm-hmm. She's in a tight spot. I would also keep an eye on Diosdado Cabello. How long is he going to accept this situation, right? Mm-hmm. And then maybe the last thing to mention is Maria Corina Machado, right?
Right.
She is a right-wing politician. What's that?
The Nobel Prize laureate, yeah.
Yes. Well, or she was, right?
Right. She
I don't
was
know if she still
she
is.
Handed it over, yeah. Right. So a few words about her, yeah.
Yes. So so she's a right-wing politician. She's very skilled as an orator. She was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize last year because of the incredible work she was able to coordinate, showing that Maduro had stolen the July 2024 presidential election. So she was able to, Venezuelan voting machines create receipts. Right. So you can see how people vote. Well, you can't see how individuals voted, but you can see how the precinct voted. And Machado was able to get the receipts from roughly 70% of the voting machines, showing that very clearly that the opposition candidate had won the election. Now, your listeners will probably recall the shameful spectacle when Donald Trump, of course, said he deserved the Nobel Prize. And I think humiliating photo where Machado is standing there with Trump. Trump's, grinning ear to ear, holding the prize. And Machado has kind of an interesting look on her face. She gave him the prize. Trump, of course, has said he thinks she's a very nice lady, but maybe doesn't have the respect to command the country. So we'll see what happens. It's mm-hmm. It's volatile and it's not over yet, for sure.
And do you think, in terms of things on the ground, do you think that it seems like people like Rodriguez and Cavallo, they are able to run the country in the meantime fairly, have kind of some kind of grip on things? Or is it pretty hectic?
For now, it seems like the military is staying loyal. The colectivos, which are these militiamen that ride around on motorcycles, they're all armed. Mm-hmm. There are about 220,000 of them, and they are staying loyal. But I just saw something today, was it today or yesterday, where the opposition is starting to take to the streets. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see what happens there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Will they be repressed? Will they be allowed to demonstrate? If they are repressed, will that give Rubio and Trump an opening? Who knows?
Do you get a sense of what kind of other forces are there in the country? I mean, in Venezuela, there's a right-wing opposition. How significant is it? How powerful is it? Do they have like any institutional backing? Do they have any kind of what t types of other kind of forces do you think are there, or as far as you can tell?
It's difficult, but Maduro, interestingly enough, was able to win over a lot of the business elite. And so if that business elite pivots to the opposition, that would be interesting. The other thing that Maduro did was crush the authentic left in Venezuela. So there is a left that was not happy with Maduro, and they were squashed. I don't know if we're going to hear from the Venezuelan left, but they're out there too. I would
Interesting.
also keep an eye on those colectivos. These are guys who are not formally trained, they're not formally in the army, but they're armed. They were kind of like the strong arm squad for the Chavistas.
Is there any activity like across borders of kind of narco terrorism and all that gets into Venezuela? Is that kind of something that might explode at some point? Given the proximity to Colombia and
The Colombian guerrillas are in Venezuela, and they are involved in the gold mining that's taking place there. So they are present, but they are, pretty entrepreneurial. I think they're more interested in making money and sort of maintaining a lifestyle than they are in taking power.
Interesting. Just a lot of, yeah, seems like a lot of moving parts and hard to anticipate what's going to happen, right? It's just these, who the heck knows. If there's one thing as historians we know is maybe we can talk about the past, but any attempt to talk credibly about the future is it seems like a silly a form of hubris that
We leave that to the political scientists, not that they're much better than we are.
Or to what's his name, Yuval Noah Harari, who keeps having like these big books about the future or whatever. He's like that he sells to all these high-tech folks, billionaires. He talks about in Davos, but yeah, us lower level historians, we just stick to the past.
Yeah, that's hard enough. Yeah.
Why do you think has the United States kind of emerged as kind of has done this now? So maybe just kind of take us a little bit, and you started to discuss this in terms of kind of how the United States had this ongoing gunboat diplomacy, and later on a continuing very, very easy trigger throughout the Western Hemisphere. What's the kind of tensions that the United States has had with Venezuela, and how are we kind of where we are today as a result of that?
Well, in a sense, you could say that oil is Venezuela's blessing and its curse, right? And tension between Venezuela and the British and US-owned oil companies that have been operating in the country for over 100 years, I think they're inevitable, right? So British and US-owned oil companies began pumping oil in the Lake Maracaibo region more than 100 years ago. And so Venezuela has had to deal with the economic or the environmental devastation that resulted and has struggled over the years to get what they consider their fair share of the profits. In the 1970s, the oil industry was largely nationalized, although foreign companies were still able to partner with the Venezuelan National Oil Company. So, and Chevron is still in Venezuela today.
So Chevron is still there, huh? Interesting. I did not know that.
Venezuela is a very small part of its portfolio, but And then, as I mentioned earlier, Venezuela had this two-party system that, and both parties were friendly to the oil companies, friendly to the U.S. But when both parties kind of lost their legitimacy in the eyes of the Venezuelan people, it kicked the door open to someone who is more radical, obviously, and an outsider like Chavez. So this is what kind of leads to the whole Chavez experience that
Right.
lasts from 1998 to 2013.
Yeah, and then the United States basically under Trump, do you have a sense of what kind of decision making that it's hard to penetrate the Trump White House. They seem to, who knows what kind of decision making they have there, but do you have at all any sense of what's going on in their minds? If they have some kind of plan, if they just some kind of they went just some kind of Trump, I don't know, his
Impulse.
impulse, anything like that?
Well, China had become Venezuela's number one trading partner.
Oh, okay.
So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. The other thing that I keep coming back to is that Rubio's parents fled Cuba. And Rubio, of course, ran for, he was in the Republican primary for the presidency in 2016. And he won a couple states, didn't he? I don't know if he won Iowa.
I don't remember, but he was, fairly up. He was up there, yeah, in the primaries.
Anyway, I think Rubio has his eye on the presidency. And so does J.D. Vance, of course. And if Rubio's probably thinking, well, if I can strangle Cuba and prevent Venezuelan oil from going to Cuba. So if I can cut that relationship, and then we can pressure Mexico to stop sending oil to Cuba, then we can finally bring Cuba to its knees. And then I can run on a platform in 2028 of having, quote unquote, liberated Venezuela and of course Cuba.
Interesting.
This is just a theory of mine,
Right.
but it's interesting to note that early in his political career, Rubio used to claim that his parents had fled Fidel Castro, but they actually fled Batista in 1956. And so NPR did an investigation about 15 years ago and called him
Right.
it called him out for misrepresenting his past. And so then he went back and fixed his Senate bio online. But I
And
wonder.
Bautista, of course, just to remind folks, was the basically American-backed president, corrupt president of Cuba before the revolution, right? Yeah, interesting. But yeah, because what I've heard is that there's some kind of ultimatum on Venezuela, right, to stop sending oil to these countries that it's doing business with, or to cut ties with all these countries, right? I think that's kind of hanging over Venezuela, some kind of ultimatum of that kind or something like.
So that would apply to Iran and Russia, I would think too, right?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
And it looked like, if for a moment there, it looked like the Trump administration would allow Mexico to continue sending oil to Cuba. I don't think it's much. I think it's like 5,000 barrels a day. But I noticed just in El País, the Spanish newspaper, a couple days ago, there was an article saying that Mexico has suspended its next shipment of oil to Cuba. And so who knows what's going on if the Trump administration is kind of tightening the screws on Claudia Sheinbaum, the president of Mexico. But if that happens, then I really, it just sounds like the
Pretty grim,
situation will get even worse.
And also another thing that came to mind as we were talking about the history of Venezuela, I think it might be useful to talk about Venezuela kind of as, in terms of a kind of a formula of trying to enact reforms that is somewhat attuned to the histories of the region, so to Cuban history, but also to say Chilean history. Kind of if you think, I mean, I think of Chavez as being kind of a student of these revolutions and modeling himself as some kind of in between path between, say, the Fidel Castro and Allende, say, in Chile. Or at least that's kind of how I've heard him discussed before as a person, right, who had some authoritarian streaks, but at least the way he often defended them is to say that we don't want the Allende situation to happen to us here. We don't want an American-backed coup, so we have to do some things aggressively in order to, right, prevent that kind of situation from unraveling, given what we know about the United States, given what we know about its tendencies. And so at least that's kind of how he defended his kind of some of his authoritarian moves, as far as I know. Are you familiar at all with that kind of line of thought about Chavez?
Yeah, you know, he really was an interesting guy. And maybe I'm dating myself by saying this on the air, but he became president the year I was hired at Chico State. And so, and I teach a modern Latin America class mm-hmm. every spring. And so I took a great interest in him. My research specialization is modern Mexico, but I took an interest in him because I thought, wow, this is petro-populism. This is a mm-hmm. populist with oil. You know, this is going to be interesting. And sure enough, it was. And again, an engaging character, but also infuriating at times, too. I mean, he mm-hmm. he also could be a real pain. But yeah, I think you're right to say that in terms of in economic strategies, he did mix capitalism with socialism. I think he was pretty omnivorous in that sense, right? He kind of he gathered from a lot of different sources. You might recall that at the first time he met President Obama, he gifted him a book by Noam Chomsky. So he read a lot. Apparently, only slept like 4 or 5 hours a day. He was a workaholic. And I should probably also mention, too, that in 2002, his enemies staged a coup against him that lasted 43 hours. So basically, the business community we don't know if the Bush administration knew what was going on, but once they certainly embraced the coup once it had happened.
Right.
And Chavez was taken by helicopter to an island off the coast of Venezuela that's controlled by Venezuela. And apparently, the people from the slums of Caracas just descended down the hillsides and surrounded the presidential palace and trapped the coup, the main coup plotters in the palace. And then they got the palace guards to kind of come back to Chavez's side. And Chavez was wrapped back after 43 hours. And so he... And I think it's at that moment in 2002 that Chavez started taking a more hard line toward his opposition, because mm-hmm. before then he was kind of happy-go-lucky, even joyful, seemed pretty relaxed. But then after 2002, what was not permitted in Venezuela was an opposition. Mm-hmm. And so he, you know, he could have been killed. And then in 2004, the opposition, by the terms of the new constitution, they were able to gather signatures and put a referendum on the ballot to recall Chavez in the middle of his term. And he defeated that referendum pretty handily. But all the people who had signed the petition for that referendum, their mm-hmm. names became part of La Lista, mm-hmm. a list that Chavez and his government used mm-hmm. to deny people government jobs and to, you know, basically punish people for calling for the referendum. So he did become more hardline, and it may be a result of that coup and then the referendum and then U.S. meddling. The George W. Bush administration meddled, mm-hmm. Never in the way that Trump just did, but lots of verbal sparring and insults going back and forth and things like that.
Right. Yeah, I used to like to talk about George W. Bush as some kind of donkey or something like that. I think. Yeah.
And they called him the devil at the UN. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I used to have. Yeah. And I should say he did some kind of unfortunate things on occasion, such as he participated in this Holocaust denying event that Iran was hosting, or he sent at least a delegate or something like that.
Well, he was friends with Ahmadinejad, right?
Ahmadinejad.
Yeah. He was friends with Muammar Gaddafi.
Right.
You know, some of his friends were questionable.
Yeah. Right. All right, let's break for a couple minutes just to give some credit to our great underwriters. We'll be back. This is Aaron Zelnick. I'm here with Steve Lewis. We're talking about Venezuela and Latin America. We're on the great Zephyr, KZFR 90.1 FM, and we'll be back in a few. The Peace and Justice Show is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, where a commitment to pure ingredients and sustainable brewing meets a legacy of craft since 1980. Sierra Nevada, taste what matters, please drink responsibly. And by Dana Campbell Law, providing compassionate, comprehensive trust in estate planning and administration. Dana, her daughter Tara, and their staff also offer healthcare directives, conservatorships, and special needs trusts with decades of experience to help protect your family's assets and peace of mind. Prepare for tomorrow and your family's future by visiting danacampbelllaw.com. All right, we're back here at the Peace and Justice Show. I'm Aaron Zelnick here with Steve Lewis talking about Latin America. Talk a little bit about, you know, we mentioned Cuba, right? A lot of the subtext that's going on here, a lot of the context is Cuba, a long-term kind of obsession of the United States, maybe for hundreds of years, really, in a sense. Right, it's kind of a miracle that Cuba is not one of the states of the United States in some regards. Like, if historically you think about it, how much Americans have wanted to take hold of Cuba over the years, and how many attempts there were actually to take hold of Cuba by the United States. And for a while, of course, Cuba was kind of a puppet of the United States, and the United States forced Cuba to have a special clause in the Cuban Constitution that allows the United States to intervene in its affairs, right? All kinds of all kinds of stuff like that. So Cuba is kind of, I think, an important subtext here. So how do you view what's going on in Cuba at this point? Do you think that's kind of where Trump is going next, maybe towards Cuba?
Yeah, well, great lead in. And I just wanted to pitch a book that I know you and I have both read, Ada Ferrer's Cuba and American History, won the Pulitzer Prize about 3 years ago. It's very readable, and it's a great book. I highly recommend it. Anyway, yes, you are right. I think Cuba is on the docket. Of course, Cuba has no oil. It has no oil, but its beaches will appeal to Trump and his cronies in the real estate development industry.
Right. If Gaza appeals to them, then Cuba surely will.
Right. I mean, if Gaza appeals to them, imagine how much nicer Cuba, right? Cuba would be, in part because Cuba has pristine beaches, unspoiled coral reefs. I've been told by divers that Cuba's coral reefs are unspoiled largely because Cuba cannot afford chemical fertilizers. So there's no runoff going into the ocean and killing off the life there, right? But here's kind of the big question mark for me. The Cuban military and the Cuban population for 65 years has been fed a steady diet of anti-imperialism, anti-Yankee imperialism. These are people who are malnourished and desperate. The question, I think, is will they finally buckle and cave into the empire? These are people who are proud, and maybe the Cuban Revolution is not what it was 30 or 40 years ago when it was guaranteeing a basic nutritional intake. And although some of the social gains of the Cuban Revolution remain, right? Like a great education system, a great healthcare system. Does Cuba become Puerto Rico, I think, is the question, right? And again, I think we should really watch whether Mexico will be allowed to continue sending oil to Cuba. Because if the supply of oil, I don't know if Cuba has any backups. If the Venezuelan supply of oil is being cut off, and if Mexico gets cut off, I don't know who else is out there, right?
Right.
Russia? I don't know.
China. Why would China be interested in Cuba? It doesn't have, you know, that much interest in.
There's no market. No one can buy their products, right?
Yeah.
So I won't be surprised if the U.S. tries something in Cuba. The U.S. might manufacture an incident It would be richly ironic if the U.S. tried to invade Cuba based on human rights concerns or restoring democracy, right?
Right.
Given what's going on in this country and, you know, because that used to be how the U.S. Justified intervention.
Right.
By either human rights violations or violations of democratic.
Right. And of course, the United States has been obsessed with Cuba, especially even more so since the Cuban Revolution. There was the Bay of Pigs in 63, yes. And there were numerous attempts to assassinate Castro. And there's constantly all kinds of angles being worked in order to put economic pressure on Cuba as well as Venezuela, right? And they're kind of seen in the same light.
The Cold War never ended for Cuba.
Right.
Right. So after 1989, the Berlin Wall comes down. The U.S., Bill Clinton went and signed a big free trade agreement with Vietnam, which, of course, had a history with the United States, right? But Cuba's transgressions, quote unquote, could never be forgiven.
Right.
In part because of the role that Florida always plays in U.S. elections, when Florida used to be a purple state. So both Democratic and Republican administrations courted the Cuban American vote. And now, of course, it's a deep red state. So,
right. But yeah. You know, perhaps because it's a deep red state, it has a lot of clout with the Trump administration, right? I mean, a lot of Cubans, like Rubio, can actually try to, pull the string there on Cuba at this point. Maybe they think this is their time.
Mm-hmm.
They have a president who's impulsive and, you know, willing to entertain all kinds of weird schemes. And that is kind of somebody who doesn't really think kind of the same way that, you know, strategically American presidents have been thinking in the last 50, 60, 70 years. So maybe for them, this is right. As you said, with Rubio, I think that's kind of, you know, maybe that's where they're headed. So I think we should. Yeah, I think we should be looking out for Cuba. We should be looking out for what's happening. We should, potentially kind of be on the, have that protest sign saying hands off Cuba ready and, already ready because, you know, it might be there in a little bit.
On the other hand, it's worth noting that post, post 1989, the U.S. has been tightening, every presidential administration, with the exception of Obama, has tried tightening the noose on Cuba. So Helms-Burton, right? Bill Clinton with the Helms-Burton Act, then George W. Bush, and frankly, Biden didn't help things at all. He did nothing for Cuba for 4 years.
Right.
So, he did nothing to roll back the restrictions that Trump applied during his first term. So the U.S. has been trying this long, but you figure that at a certain point, Cuban people just have to cry uncle.
Because there's now, from my understanding, there's now a new generation of Cubans who have not been kind of bred on the same kind of revolutionary mythology, or at least they were, but it hasn't really taken with them to the same degree. That, you know, this whole generation of revolutionaries, right? The revolution was very popular, and now it seems like the revolution is less and less popular. There's more and more people kind of just yearning for American, you know, capitalism. They're not familiar with the problems that capitalism brings to the same degree that their older generation was, or with the problems that American intervention might bring. So, I guess that's kind of right. The thinking right now is maybe this new generation of that just wants to, you know, be able to enjoy TikTok on their phones and eat and go to McDonald's. Maybe those are the ones that will bring down ultimately or help play a part in this, right?
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up. It could be a generational struggle in Cuba, right? With the older generation holding on to what they remember of the revolution, its heyday in the 1960s, 70s, early 80s. And then the people who were born after, say, 1990, knowing nothing but the so-called special period in peacetime, that's what Fidel Castro called it, when the Soviet Union collapsed and stopped supplying Cuba with oil and stopped buying Cuban sugar at above market prices. So, yeah.
And it should be said that the situation in both Venezuela and in Cuba economically is pretty tight. I mean, in Cuba even more so than in Venezuela, but that's, I mean, I think that one of the ironies here is that we are trying to fight against Venezuelan immigrants, even as we're applying economic pressure on Venezuela that creates the whole immigration problem to begin with, right? I think that's often kind of lost in this in these discussions, right? A lot of the recent, immigration overflow, as it were, or attempts to by many comes from Venezuela. Many, and the reason Venezuela is in such a tight spot, at least in part, is because the United States have applied so much economic pressure and have brought the Venezuelan economy down to its knees. And so the United States is once more reaping its own, right? And then kind of enacting these, it's just kind of absurd. And it just suggests too that whatever might happen in Venezuela in the future, we're bound to reap some kind of backfire at some point. It's going to backfire. We know that. We've known this is the history of American imperialism. It backfires in unforeseeable ways, but usually devastating ways on both local economies, but also on the United States and kind of on what happens domestically.
Yeah, lots of great points there. I would just mention that Venezuela has about 28 million people, but 8 million people have fled the country in the last 15 years, looking for a better life. The other thing that's, you made a really great point when you said that the U.S. Is, its actions are self-defeating in Venezuela. So by refusing to purchase Venezuelan oil, for example, we're really cutting off our nose to spite our face. Venezuela's oil is it's considered heavy crude, so it's very heavy in sulfur. It re requires a very elaborate refining process, right? It's not like the oil under, Kuwait or something like that. So, and the U.S. has the refineries that can handle Venezuelan crude. So when the U.S. refuses to buy most of Venezuela's oil, it's not like Venezuela can really pivot and go to a lot of different countries and sell their oil in a lot of different places, right? It's really designed to sell the bulk of its oil to the U.S. You made an interesting comment too about how U.S. foreign policy then creates problems that are unanticipated at the time, but they come back and get you. The classic example, I think, is El Salvador, the way the U.S. backed a murderous regime in the 1980s that fought a leftist national insurgency called the FMLN, and a lot of course it was a terrible situation. A country of 5 million people, 75,000 dead. A lot of people had to flee El Salvador, and they came to Los Angeles, and they kind of learned how to run criminal gangs from the gangs of L.A. And many of those Salvadorans then in the 1990s and early 2000s, after the war was over, they returned to El Salvador, but they knew how to run drugs and extortion rackets and all that. And so then the country, El Salvador's struggling democracy, had to deal with these very powerful gangs, and neither the right-wing party, ARENA, nor the FMLN, once it was in power, neither could deal with the gangs. And so you end up with a guy like Nayib Bukele, who's a young, media savvy, rich guy who, knows how to use social media, and now he's become the dictator of El Salvador, and he has these grotesque prisons that he's incarcerated 1.5% of his population. Now he's incarcerating people for the holding Venezuelans for the Trump administration.
Right. Yeah. So, nothing good, I think, can come out of all this American intervention, as we well know, Venezuela or in Cuba if and when it arrives. And let's hope it doesn't. Let's hope we'll just kind of let Cuba be Cuba and let Venezuela be Venezuela. And it usually doesn't end up well for anybody. Let's talk a little bit more about, since we have you here and since you are a specialist in Latin America more broadly, let's kind of take a step back, and just because we're talking about leftist, and this is a leftist program interested in leftist themes and kind of, right? And so I'd like to gauge kind of in Latin America more broadly how the left has been doing. It seems to me that even more than many other places in the world, we have this traditional kind of a seesaw between the left and the right that has been in play since, I don't know how long, it seems like forever. And, you know, there's this leftist wave and then this right-wing wave and so on. Where do you think we are now in that kind of storyline of leftist and right-wing waves? We have places like Chile and Bolivia on the one hand that seems like they've been taken over by capitalist forces and right-wing kind of proto-fascist forces, maybe even. But then Mexico, Brazil, Colombia, on the other hand. Do you have kind of a hot take or maybe a warm take?
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, historians always overthink things. So I don't know if this is a take, but Latin America is... there is a seesaw in Latin America. You're right. That's a great metaphor. Apart from Cuba, Latin America is a region characterized by weak states, weak and largely discredited political parties, and strong charismatic leaders who seem to defy easy ideological definition because those charismatic leaders can be on the left or the right. So the pendulum does swing widely. And this question has me thinking about, again, I'm going to date myself, my life. In the 1980s, when I was in high school and college, most Latin American countries were run by right-wing military dictatorships. Mm-hmm. But there was a trend towards democratization in the 80s and into the 1990s. And I think Latin Americans assumed that democracy would bring prosperity. But this was also a time when neoliberal economic policies were being, in some cases, forced on Latin American countries. So this is global capitalism. This is what Wall Street and the IMF and the World Bank called for, right? Where lots of industries were privatized, tariffs were dropped, state workers were fired. And ordinary people were subjected to structural adjustment agreements from the IMF that meant, you know, the lifting of subsidies and people really struggled. Ordinary people really struggled. So then it seems like around 2005 we had what they call the pink tide, where people who are now able to vote in clean democratic elections were voting for leftists. Mm-hmm. So we had Lula of Brazil, and you know, Chavez. We had Evo Morales in Bolivia, Correa in Ecuador, And for a time, these leftist populist leaders were able to take advantage of the fact that commodity prices were high. So the Chinese economy was on fire, creating great demand for raw materials that Latin America had in abundance, right? But then, and for a while, I think these pink tide governments did well. But then, in Argentina, it turned out that the Peronists, so Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, those governments were incompetent and corrupt. In Bolivia, Evo Morales, you know, his luck began to run out when commodity prices started falling in 2014. Plus, he has a penchant for underage girls and an addiction to power. So that didn't end very well. And Venezuela, we just discussed how Chavez died and oil prices fell in 2014, leading to Maduro. We just talked about El Salvador, where the leftist FMLN was just as ineffective and corrupt as the right-wing Arena Party in dealing with the gangs and other issues. And then we have Nicaragua, where Daniel Ortega has mysteriously morphed into the dictator that he helped overthrow as a young man in the 1970s. So these pink-tied governments, you know, with the exception of Lula, I think, really produced disappointing results.
Although, in the case of Morales, I think there were some results to talk about, right? In terms of
there were
some policies that seemed like they were effective, and it did give kind of bolster the native population and gave them kind of more dignity, I think,
and pulled one third of the country out of poverty. So he renegotiated the gas, oil, and lithium contracts so that the Bolivian state would get a cut,
right?
And so for a while, high commodity prices allowed him to pull, you know, a couple million people out of poverty, which is big.
But then
Evo stayed too long. It's another problem we see with these guys is they don't know how to go away quietly in the night, right?
Right.
They want to stick around. So,
and
then Evo's attempts to stage a comeback after he was removed by the army ended up destroying his political party. So he destroyed his vice president and his party in the process, and so now there is a right-wing government in Bolivia. But I think it's interesting to note that the two largest and most important countries in Latin America have center-left governments right now, so Brazil and Mexico. So maybe these two countries are somehow bucking the tide, and I tried to figure out why that was, and I think maybe this sounds like a cop out, but I think that Lula is like a once in a generation leader. You know, he's incredible, a guy who with a very limited formal education comes up through the steel and metal working plants in Sao Paulo. Runs for the presidency three times, comes up empty all three times. And his political party was a leftist. It was a leftist trade union party with Catholic influence. And then he won on his fourth try and took office in 2002, did two terms, left office in 2010 with the highest approval ratings. His approval ratings were like 80%. It was nuts. He'd been in power for eight years. And then, of course, he came back. Then he was incarcerated after a judicial coup against his mentee, Dilma Rousseff. He spent about a year and a half in jail, got out of jail, started campaigning immediately, and won the election in
take it from Bolsonaro. Yeah.
And now he's 80 years old and talking about running for a fourth term later this year, which is nuts.
Right.
So I just think Lula's exceptionally gifted, and Bolsonaro he almost won re-election. But interesting to note that Brazil, with its, I think, more fragile democracy than this country, we tend to think of Brazil having more fragile institutions, it came out of a dictatorship in the mid-1980s. It was able to try and convict a former president for staging a coup and denying the results of an election. In this country, the political class punted,
right?
Republicans gave Trump cover.
Yeah.
So Bolsonaro cannot run for, he's been sentenced to prison. And so he wants to have his son run in his place. But I think Lula is probably the favored candidate to win the election later this year. So I think, Lula's just exceptional, which I think explains why Brazil is still in the center-left column. Mm-hmm. And going to Mexico, which is kind of my my sweet spot, there's another once-in-a-generation politician, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, or AMLO, who kind of the consummate outsider who won election in 2018, and then by running against the system.
Right.
What's helped AMLO is, or what helped him is that the two main establishment parties were completely discredited by their lack of effectiveness, their embrace of neoliberal policies, and their corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then his acolyte is Claudia Sheinbaum, who's a very interesting character, right? The first woman president in Mexico's history.
Fascinating figure, yeah.
Jewish, yes.
A woman, a Jewish woman. Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah.
And a very accomplished one too. She has a PhD in environmental
By a scientist, yeah.
engineering. And she, the Europeans call her the Trump Whisperer because she has so far been able to hold Trump at bay, and she's been able to play a very weak hand very well. So Mexico's 80% of Mexico's exports go to the United States. So when Trump threatens tariffs on Mexico, it's a very serious threat. The Mexican economy is kind of flatlining right now. AMLO spent a lot of money, left Sheinbaum with a lot of debt to deal with, and then she has to deal with these criminal organizations that are very powerful. Of course, Mexico shares a border with the country that consumes more illicit drugs than any other country in the world, and the country that refuses to pass meaningful gun legislation, moderating the sale of firearms, especially in states like Arizona and Texas. So 85% of the guns recovered at crime scenes in Mexico were purchased legally in the United States. So Sheinbaum, it's hard not to be sympathetic. She has a very tough job, right? Basically zero economic growth, organized crime that her predecessor did not deal with because his policy was abrazos, no balazos. Well, I mean, it seems like a joke, but translates hugs, not gunshots. That's how we're going to deal with these heavily armed organized crime syndicates, right? But she's actually dealing with them. She's going after some of these people. She's turning them over, for better or for worse. She's turned them over to the U.S. And she recently announced another hike to the minimum wage, which will help ordinary Mexicans. And the social AMLO's social programs remain in place, but she has a very tough job right now.
And somehow she's pretty popular, it seems like.
She is.
Which is kind of fascinating to see. I think just people appreciate think that kind of believe her. She seemed like a kind of a genuine kind of type of person, kind of like Lula a little bit maybe. In that
She's
like
not as
just
charismatic as Lula, but she's smart and careful.
And
And
it's
again,
it's fascinating just to see what's going on there in Mexico under Sheinbaum. It's it's an interesting figure too, and also just weird to think how in a country once more you said Brazil is kind of this fragile democracy. Mexico, we often think of it as a kind of a or at least Latin Americans in general as these kind of more macho people who are like don't give women enough rights or whatever. But nevertheless, they're the ones who had a woman president and a Jewish president at that, right? Also, supposedly a Catholic country. Yeah, anyway, a lot of weird kind of things happening with it.
That's right.
Anyway, thanks for, taking all these questions,
Yeah,
flooring
it's
all
been
these
fun.
questions for me, and and staying nimble, even though I asked you some new ones that I had prepared ahead of time,
That's no, it's fun. Yeah.
This was Steve Lewis. He's a professor at Chico State. If you want to take a class with him, he gives classes on Latin America. So you can do that.
All they let me do here. All right.
Anyway, this was good. Thanks, Steve. And
Thank you.
we're out of time here. So this was the Peace and Justice Show with Ron Zelnick. That's it for now. I'll be with you again in some few weeks' time. All right. The Peace and Justice Show is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state local partner with the California Arts Council. Since 2011, Friends of the Arts has been creating economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and publishing bi-monthly arts and culture newsletters. To stay in the know or to have your event listed, visit friendsof.art. Friendsof.art. and by Lost on Main at 319 Main Street in Chico, presenting a fundraising show for Safe Space on Saturday, February 21. The band includes Americana,